TFM.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Saddle Up, our dedicated Star Trek Strange New Worlds podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I am so happy that you broke out the Yahtzee today, because I always love a little game before we start recording.
Well, Chris, I wasn't sure anybody else would know that game, you know, it being such an old Earth game, but I goodness, Yahtzee, I'm so glad. And now we can get to playing, but I feel like, I don't know, maybe we should podcast first and then possibly play some Yahtzee?
However you want to do it, it's fine with me. You know, just as long as we get our board games in, I'm fine.
Okay, well, I mean, it is important. Board games are good for you. You know, they really help you, you know, figure things out, mental acuity, all of those type of things. So, you know, I mean, you can't put a price on what a good board game can do for you.
That's right, everyone. This episode brought to you by Milton Bradley.
If only.
I'm just picturing the rec room on the Enterprise, and along one wall, there are these shelves, and they've just got Monopoly and Operation the game of life.
Operation is how Dr. McCoy, you know, keeps his skills sharp. So,
exactly. All right, everyone. We are going to talk about the second episode of Strange New Worlds, Children of the Comet. Here's a quick rundown of the story. When a comet threatens to impact the planet Persephone 3, the Enterprise prepares to render what would appear to be routine assistance, at least for Starfleet. But the comet turns out to be more than it appears, and a race calling itself the Shepherds threatens to destroy Pike and his crew for interfering in what they see as the preordained course of an object that brings life to planets. Uhura's musical talent saves the day as Spock works on his pep talks in this story that fills in the linguist's background like never before. So let's jump in, Matthew. And I remember last time we both felt that the little moments where we saw Uhura, it was a little bit like, hey, look at me, I'm Uhura. And we were hoping they're going to do more with the character. And they sure did in this episode. They centered the whole story around her, gave us background. And I feel totally different about the character in this series after this one.
Yeah, I think this is, I'm wondering if, you know, each episode of the show is going to take a moment to kind of spend more time with specific characters in each episode, so that, you know, by the time we get to the end of the season, we know each one of these characters much better. And so this episode specifically did have quite a bit of Uhura in it, as well as Spock. And so both of those characters interacting together has been really interesting, especially on this show. Of course, one of the things that was most fascinating to me was the way in which this seemed to kind of mimic their relationship a little bit in the Kelvin timeline, them being much closer there and having much more interaction in general, which is definitely something that this episode gives us quite a bit of, which was, to me, like, quite fascinating. I thought it was good, the fact that we got the opportunity to spend more time with this character who, you know, like you said, we both kind of felt like, well, it wasn't bad at all, that the first episode, but it was kind of more in your face, like, that moment of like, hey, look at me, I'm Uhura. Do you remember me, Uhura, from the original series? That's me, I'm here. So everybody look at me and pay attention to me real quick. This episode, I think, really takes care of that and makes her more a part of the crew. And I think, I mean, I don't know if they, you know, thought of their own, they had their own criticisms, you know, as they were creating the episodes. But I think this one is it's clear that somebody on the writing staff was like, okay, we need to legitimize why this character is here in the first place.
Yeah.
And so we need to do that up front. And I think it was a really great choice because, like you said, we get a big opportunity to know her in a way that we've never known her before, really learn about her past and kind of what's driving her to be here and what's not driving her to be here, which was also quite interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Before getting into Uhura specifically here, just going back to what you mentioned of the possibility that each episode this season might fill us in on the background of each character so that we really get to know them. I think they could do that effectively because if you look at this story, they did a great job, I felt, of really giving us background to Uhura, letting us get to know her, mm-hmm. while at the same time giving us a story that felt like that traditional TOS, yep. TNG style, here's one yes. crisis we yep. need to solve. And also tying that story into what's going on mentally with Pike, mm-hmm. which we'll talk yes. about in a little while with yep. his fate. So
yes,
they've been very adept so far at tying all these pieces mm-hmm. together, which would allow 100%. Them to focus on a single character in one episode without us feeling like the entire episode is only about that character. And that I really like. As for Uhura here, mm-hmm. yeah, I think that they did need to legitimize why Uhura is on this show. They did for me because when they announced that she was going to be a character on the show, my reaction was a bit mixed. On the one hand, I Same. Thought, okay, this is great. If they do something with the character, this will be nice to add texture, fill in the background, mm-hmm. let us get to know a character that we all are very familiar with by name, but didn't right. get a lot of screen time for reasons of how TV worked back then.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But
yeah.
on the other hand, I felt like let's not stack the deck too much with familiar names just because this yes. is the Enterprise, right? So I wasn't sure.
Absolutely.
I wasn't sure what they were going to do. And that's why I wasn't as thrilled with what we saw in the first episode. Mm-hmm. But here, I thought that the character really came to life. I felt like Celia Rose Gooding did a great job of making this her own character, but also making it believable that this is a young Uhura mm-hmm. that we've known before.
Yes.
And having her be someone who is a prodigy, but landed in Starfleet because of a family tragedy.
Right.
And is someone who obviously would be an enormous asset to Starfleet, but mm-hmm. they themselves aren't quite sure if they want to be here. I also like that element of the story because with only a few exceptions in Star Trek, have we seen characters that weren't just jumping at the chance to be in Starfleet. You know, Jake right. Sisko comes to mind yep. as a character who
yeah.
didn't want to go down that route, even though it would have yeah. been natural for him. And mm-hmm. I also like the fact here that they are making her that kind of character because it's going to allow them to mm-hmm. develop a rich character in Uhura for
right.
us.
Well, you know, one of the things I think that I was just thinking as you were saying that, there are many people who go into the military and they don't plan on that being their entire career.
Sure.
And Starfleet is much more than a military organization, but in many ways, it is one. And therefore, for somebody to kind of go into the military because they're not quite sure what it is that they want to do and are utilizing that in a way to grow their skills and those type of things makes complete sense and it fits, you know. And I think one of the things that makes that so interesting is that for Uhura, Spock reminds her that she could be actually stealing a place from somebody who really wants to be here, which is a little bit different than, you know, the military of today. You know, there's plenty of space for anyone, but here, this ship only gets what they said, 10 cadets a year. So the fact that she's here means that she is at the top of her game in her field. but it also means that you have to continue to earn your place on the Enterprise, or I'm sure that you'll be shipped off somewhere else. And so her getting that lesson, I think, here, and the idea of finding your place and being somewhere for a reason is something that just kind of plays into the entire episode, which is this idea of, are things predestined or are they not? Is there free will or is there there? That's a big question, and that's what this episode is kind of asking in many ways. And so I think it's interesting that the horror story kind of mirrors that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I do like that they built on what we did already know about her. You know, the fact that she's from Kenya, the fact that she grew up near Lake Simbi-Niama, that all comes from the Savage Curtain in the original series. So that's something that was established that we knew. And then on top of that, they start building layers for the character, which ultimately takes us to what you were just talking about right there. So while we're talking about her, let's just go ahead and talk about the core of the story and how she gets them out of the escape room, which is the musical aspect. Another thing that we've known about her is that she sings. We learned that in Charlie X all the way at the beginning of the first season of the original series. And they also worked that into the plot of Star Trek V. And here, it's the key to solving the mystery. And I really loved it as a musician. I think people listening to this show may not know, but other shows may know that I actually was an orchestral musician for many years and went to music school and have a degree in music and all that stuff. So I love it when they work music into the episodes. But what I also really liked about this one is that they did it in a way where they tied it into math. So they connected arts and science and math all together, which is a great formula for a science fiction story and for a Star Trek story.
Right. Which comes straight from Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
That's the first thing that popped into my head when the sounds started.
So it's not as though it's a new idea.
Yeah, of course.
But
it's
definitely one, I think, that makes sense to be done here and to utilize their strengths. And you know, music is a language based in math, which makes sense then why it would be something that would be universally understood by many different races and be a way of communication. Again, harkening back to the whole idea of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that this was great. We did learn Spock's not really a singer.
but and, he tried. I mean, he gave it his all, Matthew.
He very much did. He very much did. And it helped enough for them to be able to communicate with Mahanit and be able to lower the shields and be able to get off the comet and get back to the Enterprise and then make the difference that they do by working together, even though they don't realize they're actually working together.
Well, this whole environment, apart from the Close Encounters, which is the first thing that popped in my head when that started, the whole environment inside the comet with the lights and the sounds and all reminded me of two places that we have here in Tokyo, which are done by this group called Team Lab, which do like projection mapping and very complex stuff. And you've probably seen some of their work before, actually, because they have installations around the world. But we have one called Borderless, which is a digital art museum. It's absolutely massive. And you're immersed in this environment of lights and sounds and things that you do. The interaction has an effect on the environment. And then there's another one called Planets. And this, it felt to me like Mahanit was designed by Team Lab.
You know, what I was thinking of is the fact that it felt very much like the original series and Enterprise. I was specifically thinking of Expected with Enterprise and the way the walls glow and all of that. I thought that was very reminiscent of all of that. So what I think really good job here by the production designers to be creating things to which really lend to this time period and don't feel so advanced that you just get lost, and you're kind of drawn out of the time period that you are supposed to be in. And this very much felt like it could have been on the original series, mm-hmm. which is exactly what you want. And, you know, this also felt like a solution that might come from the original series, which I thought was great as well. And in fact, I think the whole philosophical side of this is something that we haven't seen a ton of since, I think, really Deep Space Nine. And this episode very much was asking some big theological questions about life. And I thought that was excellent. And it did not do the thing that the original series would sometimes do, which is kind of give you a trite answer and move on. This one gave you a lot to chew on and left you realizing, yeah, our Starfleet crew wasn't actually right.
Right, right. I think that ties in well with Pike's character because they established mm-hmm. at the beginning of season two of Discovery that he has a faith and he's more open-minded to these possibilities, I think, than we've seen with some of the other captains or Starfleet officers. And asking these questions in this series with him being the leader of the crew works pretty well. And also, mm-hmm. it also allows them to tie in to his own existential
right. yes.
Conundrum that he's in right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it was interesting, and I'm glad you bring that up because, you know, I think what was fascinating to me was watching how Pike and the crew of the Enterprise very much assume a lot of things. They assume they know what's going on, and then that assumption leads them down all the wrong roads in many ways. And because of that, they get their preconceptions challenged, and they come to realize that they might not know as much, honestly, as they thought that they did. They actually, you know, pretty well judged an entire race known as the Shepherds as quote unquote extremists just
well,
because
Pike
they didn't understand
zealots,
them.
Which
exactly
which by definition fits what he was told by the leader of the Shepherds, but yeah.
Well, I mean,
and I don't mean in a religious sense, I just mean in the
right,
definition
right, right.
of the word zealot. Because mm-hmm. actually Pike's comment kind of mm-hmm. caught me a little bit at first, and I had to think about it a little bit because at first I took it with a religious connotation, which I don't think is what mm-hmm. was intended.
Yeah, I mean it could be that. I definitely personally did take it more and I don't think you'd be surprised is that I did take it that he was calling them that in a mm-hmm. more religious connotation. But I thought it was interesting here. What we truly see is the fact that Pike and the crew of the Enterprise do judge this alien race before they really have true understanding of these people and what's actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads them to make decisions to which actually could have been detrimental to the planet and what they're trying to do because they don't understand the full context the same way that the Shepherds do.
Mm-hmm.
They think they do, but they don't. And I really liked the nuance of that, of the Shepherds even say, the leader of the Shepherds even says, you know, maybe you won't be so quick to judge other people's faith in the future, which we don't really think of. But I think, again, this episode does a fantastic job of being able to allow us the opportunity to think about things on a different level. And Pike, I think, wonderfully realizes here he is going to need to start thinking on things on different levels and maybe not be so quick to jump to conclusions that mm-hmm. he knows exactly what's going on, which is a great place to be as a starship captain.
Right. And it kind of echoes Enterprise and Archer and that crew and what they learn
mm-hmm.
in their first season of outings. Yeah, going back to him calling them zealots for a moment, the reason I think that may not be what was intended is because I don't think it fits Pike's character as he's been established since the start of Discovery season two to now. Although you may be right that that was the implication in terms of the writing, but if it was, I think the great thing about the story is what you just explained. He opens his mind to it.
Yes.
And sees it in a different light. And the ending of the story, when we find out that perhaps even Spock's flight around the comet in the shuttle was preordained, really makes them realize that,
yes,
okay, these people have faith in something. They were doing it because they've always done it. They just believed it. They had faith in it. They may have had no true evidence that this comet followed a preordained course and seeded life, but they believed it, and it is part of who they are. And whereas the Enterprise crew questioned that, by the end, they are willing to accept that and probably, as you're saying, will change how they go into situations in the future.
Sure. You know, I would say this is one of the things is they really do, though, assume that they know a lot more about the shepherds than they actually do. And I think one of the things that is interesting is the shepherds talk about the idea that they have been doing this job of shepherding these comets, which are, they call, ancient arbiters of life. And they've been doing this job for such a long time. And so you would assume then that they have had direct contact with not only the comets themselves, but they have seen them do these things for generations, right? I mean, they wouldn't be doing this job if they didn't have some basis for their belief. Like, I don't think it's just a thing where they just think, oh, well, we just do this thing and, you know, there's actually, I'm guessing there is a very firm foundation for their belief in this Mahanit, these comets, these arbiters of life, because of not only their belief system, but actual experience with them as well. So you put those two things together, and I think that's what we get. And again, that's the beauty of what I think Pike learns, right? And you absolutely said it correctly. I think, you know, Pike wonderfully opens his mind to the fact that he was wrong and this may be the case. And I think even unlike number one, he is in a place where I think he's willing to believe in something beyond himself and this idea that he's here for a reason. Maybe the reason that he's there to save those people that die was because of something he doesn't know about what they're going to go on and do, right? So, I mean, there's, again, the beauty of this is much like a Deep Space Nine episode, we're having a really in-depth conversation, and this is the kind of thing that Star Trek should and, when it's at its best, does. So, very happy that we're getting to, you know, have that type of conversation here about this show, because after the first episode, I didn't know if that was going to be the case, but, you know, this episode, having watched it a few times, very excited to kind of see what else they're going to be throwing at us, because this gave me a lot of hope for where this show is going to go.
Yeah. So. Well, they're raising questions and exploring those.
Yes.
And doing it in a way that allows us to explore and think as well, instead of just having a message that they want to tell you and leading you through it, and you're supposed to just take it or leave it, right?
Which is something that Anson Mount had said, and I think we talked about that one of his quotes where he said, look, our goal is to raise questions and to present them to the audience and not tell you what to think. This is an episode where that legitimately happened. You were not told what you think. You were just given a bunch of information, and it's like, it could go either way. I don't know. But that's the fun of it, is that it can lead to all of this type of conversation and speculation for fans. And I think it's all the better for it. Again, that's what the best, you know, why we continue talking on the Orb about Star Trek Deep Space Nine all the time, is because it allows us to continually question, and from different sides of the perspective. And yet at the same time, we can still have the conversation that allows both of us to do it respectfully, which, like, this show is doing as well.
So. Yeah, absolutely. And to follow up about the Shepherds and why they're doing what they do, I can picture, if we could learn more about them, because they've been doing this for so long, they must have records. So you can imagine mm-hmm. Shepherd scientists analyzing the paths mm-hmm. of these comets and how they have interacted with other planets. Mm-hmm. And that would be the mm-hmm. basis for them believing so strongly that they must continue to guide and protect mm-hmm. these
and
arbiters of life.
Trusting them to, you know,
yeah,
these comets to make the right decision, right? One that they might not necessarily themselves understand because of that fact.
So let's talk a little bit more about Pike. And before we get into his existence and all this, let's let's go on the lighter side for a minute, because you called it last show, Cooking with the Captains. You called it, Matthew. Oh.
Yes.
And boy, did we get it in this episode. What did you think about this
dinner
party?
I mean, he was making ribs.
He was making ribs.
I mean, man's got a smoker, I'm thinking, in his cabin, which is amazing. I mean, can we just, again, talk about how cool the cabin is for the captain here? I love Pike's quarters. I want to live there, honestly. I feel like it's one of the best things I've seen Star Trek do design-wise in a long time.
Yeah.
To really make you feel like that the place is inviting, and yet at the same time feels Star Trek-y, right? It feels like the future, and it feels also like the original series all at the same time. And so I love his quarters. I actually had to go and look up how large this Enterprise is supposed to be, because his quarters are actually pretty big. Now, I will say, the second time rewatching the episode, they're not as big as they come off.
Mm-hmm.
I think the way they film makes it feel bigger than it actually is.
Yeah.
But this Enterprise is supposedly 50% bigger than the original series Enterprise, which makes it a very big ship. And so for the captain to have these type of quarters makes sense, especially with the fact that as Pike uses them, he uses them as a way to welcome other people into his home. It's literally, I mean, that's what this is. It is his home mm-hmm. To entertain and to get to know his crew. Very reminiscent of what we saw with Commander Sisko doing, having people over for dinner.
Yeah.
So I think this is great. I mean, this makes me love the character of Pike so much. And, you know, makes me excited the fact that we're going to get the opportunity to continue to get to know this character.
Well, he's the exact opposite of Picard on The Next Generation, right? Where Picard had this wall between himself and the crew. And here Pike not only invites people over, he cooks for them. And then he tells them stories. And then if they mm-hmm. need to talk, he listens to them, and he's very supportive and encouraging.
I mean, he's talking about tripping over the pants of a Nausicaan, you know, so that's not something you're going to get Picard ever telling you that story.
Well, my advice is to always stay away from Nausicaans, but if you see a Nausicaan in bell bottoms, you better really stay away, because you don't want to trip over those pants.
Well, I mean, a Nausicaan without pants on, too. I mean, I feel like that's definitely a character that you don't need to be spending time with.
No, but it sounds like a great art project for some of these people on Twitter who do these wonderful drawings and share them. A Nausicaan mm-hmm. without pants.
Oh, man. This is a family show, Chris. So we're going to let some other people create that, and we will laugh at it,
Yes.
I don't know if we should be the ones to do it.
We will laugh at it the way that Uhura laughed at Pike's joke with yes. extreme vigor.
Well, you know, when the captain makes a joke, you laugh at it.
Especially
right?
when you're a cadet in your dress uniform. Yeah.
Exactly. Which can I mention too that I really, I thought that that was great, part of the episode, but you know, Ortegas, I think one of the, we were kind of worried about her character a little bit, mm-hmm. I think rightly. She's just become, she's very funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I think her humor works so well with the captain's humor. I think she's an enjoyable character. I think she reminds me a little bit of, you know, if you put Sulu and Chekhov together, especially in the movies, you know, uh-huh. she's kind of that type of character where she's a little bit of comic relief, which is something you need. She's somebody that the captain trusts. She has a good relationship with the captain, and with pretty much everybody in the crew. And it's one of those things which I think is just so important for this type of show. You need those characters which are easy to kind of enjoy them being there without them having to necessarily take up a ton of story time. And she's definitely, I think, one of those characters. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I think that she's a character to which we're going to enjoy having her on the series, but they may never have to spend copious amounts of time telling us their backstory.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay. Not every character needs to be like that. And I think Ortegas might be that character here. And I'm enjoying her character. I think she's funny. Her prank on Uhura was fantastic. And, you know, the kind of thing that you would expect to have happen, especially between like a Chekhov and Sulu. You can clearly see a Sulu doing that to Chekhov back in the day, right? So all that to say, I think it's a good job so far that the show is doing, and it's doing it kind of effortlessly for the most part, I believe.
Well, they're giving her stuff to do as well. She's not just sitting up there.
Yes.
She's not just someone who Pike says her name from time to time and we see her press a button. And
exactly.
You know, she's...
Can we talk about that real quick too, Chris?
Uh-huh.
How good the Enterprise looks in the sense of them creating these systems that feel like the original series with the big colory buttons,
mm-hmm.
but also at the same time have some of like the iPad touch button type things,
mm-hmm.
as well as levers. It's like they've thrown in every single part of the Star Trek family. So it feels like Enterprise, it feels like the original series, and it feels like TNG all mashed together. And that's really smart. It's one of those things where I'm having to give credit to the creators here.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing a very good job in allowing us to feel like this is somewhat like the Enterprise that you might, I guess, at least more see in the movies, which is phenomenal. Keep it up, guys.
Yeah, if they had taken the original Enterprise bridge from the original television series and used that mm-hmm. bridge in the movies, and they had updated that so that it would look good on a big screen in a movie theater.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say they did that in the early 90s when the last TOS film came out. Yeah, it might be something like this, right? And of course, it's further updated now because now we have all the touch technology that we use all the time, and they need to mix that in, but not go overboard with it. Yeah, I think they've done a great job of updating the Enterprise bridge and the interiors and all to make it feel like the ship we know, but mm-hmm. also to meet our expectations for modern television.
Yep. Yeah. So, I mean, it's something I was, and I think you knew, I was definitely worried about, but I think, you know, they've just done a good job of creating something that works, mm-hmm. which is special. And, you know, it makes me think, obviously, of the original series movies Enterprise, which is my favorite Enterprise anyway. So well done.
the 1701 refit.
Oh, yes. Especially the one from Star Trek VI.
Yeah.
Because this feels like that, where you've got some of the the touchscreen stuff, you've got some of the old school stuff, and it all just kind of is melded together into a really nice package, which it's something that you want to feel like this Enterprise is the one that Kirk is going to inherit.
Yeah, which I still think we may see happen. All right, well,
we could, you know, as long as his brother doesn't die on the ship, you know, that'd be great.
I wonder if that's going to become a recurring thing, that Sam Kirk almost dies in every episode.
Sam Kirk almost dying. Sam Kirk's in the infirmary again.
They really
maybe
should
it's his
do
mustache
that.
That's keeping him alive.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. There's something there in that mustache. That's why Pike should get one of his own. But
absolutely.
I would love that if that became a running joke, that Sam Kirk almost dies in every episode.
That would be hilarious and quite sad for Sam Kirk.
Right. True, true. All right. Okay, well, continuing on about Pike, as I mentioned earlier, one thing that I really loved about this story is how they took the purpose of Mahani and the idea of fate, things being foretold, preordained course for this comet, and how that mirrors what's going on with Pike, knowing his future, knowing that 10 years from this moment, he's going to be critically injured and his life will be transformed. And again, I do think that the thread running through this series, certainly the first season, is going to be him coming to terms with that. And at the end of this episode, number one asks him, what if your fate is what you make it? So there's this idea of, okay, you've seen what's going to happen to you, but does that have to happen? Does it have to happen the way you saw it? What control do you have over your life? And can life be what you make it under the circumstances?
Mm-hmm. I do think it's a really interesting question. Obviously, one of the things that this episode does is that it throws into question number one's question and whether or not she's asking the right question, I think,
mm-hmm.
which is, we saw in this episode that Spock's actions and the actions of the Enterprise fit perfectly in alignment with the preordained run of Mahanit, and that those things together are what help save the planet. This idea of like knowing the future, I think the real question is that it can be seen from many different ways. And so whether or not Pike clearly understands the whole picture and the context of everything that's going to happen then is a really big question. And so it's not so much that he makes his own future. We already know that's not the case. Pike is not going to make his own future. He's, we know what's going to happen to him. So we know he is preordained to have this happen, and it's going to happen, and there's nothing he can do about it. But being able to see the context of everything is something we don't have. And I find that really interesting because this episode showed us that context matters when it comes to the idea of predestination and prophecy, really. And that's really a question that I don't think anybody will be able to answer. You know, which is kind of fascinating, and as a human, obviously, it's frustrating. But I think it makes for a much more interesting discussion moving forward than anything else. So,
well, Lorca said, "Context is for kings," and that is,
and it absolutely is
sort of the point of this story. Right at the end is that context matters, and within the context of Pike's future, he is thinking about all of these cadets who he will save in the future who are kids at the moment. And you know, he looks them up at the end, and I think I felt a bit that after learning that Spock's actions appeared to be preordained, and if Spock had not made the flight, then the course, the destiny of this comet may not have happened. But then again, it had to happen because it was preordained. So it's as if on the timeline, no matter what, the Enterprise is going to be there. Spock is going to make that flight.
Yes.
And because he does it, and this water vapor and then rain comes down into the atmosphere, which is going to change the future of the people on this planet, the actions benefit others in a way that they would have never have thought. And so I feel like that's what Pike is beginning to consider is that, okay, this is going to happen to me in the future, but because it happens to me, how will it affect those who I save, and how will it affect the course of their lives? So that was a good way of mirroring, you know, a story with the Arbiter of Life. And you mirror these two courses, two storylines very well.
And the fact that the comet and Spock working in tandem, that's a big part of this whole thing. And so then having Pike working in tandem with whatever is going to happen in the future, I think is another really important aspect to this. And him being willing to give in to predestination and trust that there's something on the other side is really interesting. And I do think that that's one of the things that is fascinating, is that Pike isn't aware at this moment that he will not actually spend his life in this wheelchair and be bound to it forever. He's going to be able to go to Talos IV, and that's going to change his life in a way that he can't see coming right now because he hasn't experienced the cage yet.
Right.
And so I think that's really interesting because we already have the pieces of the puzzle and understand a lot of things that Pike doesn't understand. All that's left now is for Pike to trust that there's some reason for this that he may not be able to figure out until much later on. And that's just a... It's a fascinating thing. It's a difficult thing, especially for us as human beings, because we want to know. And a lot of times we don't know until much later on. With perspective and time, we can see something in a way that isn't available to us at that time. You know, so I think that's another, like, that's a part of this, and it makes for a really interesting discussion, and it makes it difficult because it absolutely is difficult as a human being to accept that. We want to be the one in control. And to quote Jurassic World, it's when you finally learn that you're not in control that you can really be free, because we're never really truly in control of our lives. So,
yeah, that's very true. What would you think about in this series at some point, if they remade the cage? Because the cage originally never aired.
Right, you're right, man.
And it is something, you said he hasn't experienced the cage yet. And so it is something that he does need to experience. It's part of that journey. And so it could be interesting if they actually revisited that and updated the story a little bit to fit in with current social norms. But have him have that experience, because you've got all the characters right there on the show.
I think...
And I enjoyed when they revisited Talos IV on Discovery. I thought that episode was quite nice.
I think it's an interesting idea. The problem that you do run into is the fact that the cage does exist within canon in the original series, even though... It it never actually aired as that episode.
Right.
You know, so there's that whole thing. But to be able to do that, I actually don't know if that's a terrible idea to allow this character to be able to go through that before we hand off this Enterprise to Kirk.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm sure a lot of other fans probably have a lot of ideas. So they can yell at us on Twitter and tell us how wrong we were. But I think that you're onto something in the sense that it holds weight as an idea.
Yeah.
And it could possibly be a really interesting one to experience with Anson Mount as this character.
Yeah, I think we would get a mix. I think some people would be, no way. There's no way you could remake an episode that already exists. And some people might say, yeah, that could be an interesting idea. I think within the context of the series, it would make sense. Within the context of the franchise, it might be a bit odd.
Sure.
So, all right. Well, okay, let's move on to...
I mean, we've already moved around the eugenics wars 1,000 times,
right?
You know? So, like, I don't know, is this one a bigger sin? That's a good question.
Yeah. And another thing that we may talk about a few weeks from now is how they're handling stardates, because, you know, the stardates and those of the original series already don't match up. And there was a big jump between the first episode and this one. And so I'm curious to see if they're going to settle into something a bit more linear, or if they're going to pay homage to the original series by giving us random star dates that jump back and forth and back and forth. I don't know.
Star dates that don't make any sense.
I know some of that was due to the fact that episodes were shot in one order and aired in a different one, but it's not just that. Some of it's just the writing. It's just, let's just throw a number out there. So, anyway, we'll see. Okay, let's talk about one last point here before we wrap up, and that's Hemmer, because the chief engineer came to the ship right at the end of the last episode, and so we didn't get to talk about him. What did you think about this, having an Anar? Anars are blind, of course, and he's being played by Bruce Horak, who himself as an actor is blind.
I think it's great. I think this is one of those things where they're really going to give us an opportunity to spend time with a character that in a race that we haven't really spent a ton of time with, except for on Enterprise. And, you know, most shows have not done a great job with the Andorians in the first place. So the fact that we're going to be spending much more time with an A&R and an Andorian is phenomenal. So I think it's great to be able to give this actor this opportunity that does not come around very often. And I think for him to be the chief engineer is a great story point for us. And, you know, to be able to watch him use his other senses to help run this ship, I think is going to be really cool. And I'm looking forward to getting a chance to spending more time with him and possibly, you know, getting to meet other Andorians as well. I think this opens the door for that as we learn more about this character. So, yeah, I'm 100% on board. And I think it, you know, I've always been a huge fan of the Andorians in the first place. So I say give us more.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad that he's here. And I'm glad that they made him an Anar and not just an Andorian. So we get to learn a bit more about them. And I do think he's one of the characters for sure who we're going to get an episode dedicated to his background and his history, like we were talking about at the beginning of the discussion today. And I also like the fact that, you know, this is the second time on Star Trek where the chief engineer has been blind. And in the case of Geordi,
very true.
He had the visor,
yeah,
and he could see in a different way. I think here with Hemmer, like you said, it's going to be more about using his other senses rather than having some other way of viewing the environment like Geordi did. But it's a great message, just as it was with Geordi. Mm-hmm. It's a great message today to people that if you're interested in sciences or engineering or whatever it is, You know, even mm-hmm. if you can't use your eyes, it doesn't mean that you can't reach the highest levels. He's the chief engineer of the Enterprise, right? You can reach yep. the highest levels no matter what. And I think that's one of the mm-hmm. messages that Star Trek should be sending. They have sent many times, and they're continuing to do it here, which was great. Okay, well, final thoughts and your rating for this one, Matthew.
Mm-hmm. Well, this episode was much better, I felt like, than the first episode. And I think it did a very good job of creating a place and a ship that I want to spend more time with. It helped me really enjoy the characters much more in ways that make them people I'm looking forward to spending time with, you know, every Thursday, which I think is really important. You know, you want to create television and characters that people want to spend time with and that they want to watch the episode as quickly as possible because they want to spend more time with their friends. And, you know, I feel like this crew, much like the crew of, I would say the crew of the Enterprise NX-01, they just, everybody feels really down to earth and like a character you would want to have a beer with, right? Which is an important thing. And so I'm very much looking forward to where we go next in this show. I don't really watch any of the trailers or anything for what's coming next week.
Yeah, same.
Every week I'm just surprised at what comes, which I find to be much more fun. So I would give this episode, I would probably 7.5 out of 10 barbecued spare ribs out of the captain's kitchen, because goodness, not only does that sound delightful, but I mean, I want to have a beer with Pike and his massive quarter. So yeah, this was a really good episode. What about you, Chris?
Yeah, same. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the first episode, but I did think that this episode was stronger, and it captured everything that I love about Star Trek. And as we discussed at length today, the fact that it raises questions and gives you different views and makes you think about it. I like that they're getting all the characters involved. The visuals are great. I did find it a little bit odd how the Enterprise flies through the asteroid field, because a ship that big to maneuver like that is a little bit
yeah, odd. It's not the Millennium Falcon.
Odd to me, but but overall, yeah, it was a really great episode. And I knew you were going to give it barbecue ribs, so I had to think of something else. I'm going to give it 8 practical jokes.
Nice. Nice.
Well, everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on Children of the Comet as well. There are many ways for you to share those. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our group for listeners. It is a closed group, so if you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. And to find that, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or type the whole name if it doesn't come up, and you'll find a post there for this episode, and you can share your comments with fellow listeners and us right there on the timeline. You can also send us email if you prefer. Just go to our website, trek.fm/contact, choose to send to a show, and choose Saddle Up. And that'll come to Matthew and me by Pony Express. And you can find us in social media, on Twitter, Instagram, everywhere. Our username is TrekFM. Now, Matthew, when you're not working on your pep talks, where can people find you?
Well, you know, Chris, I got to say that takes a lot of time. It's a lot more difficult than I thought it was going to be. But when I'm not doing that, you can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02. And then here on the network, doing so many different shows. So I hope people will check those out. Shows like the 602 Club, or we talked about The Orb and Warp 5, Artificial Tango, Literary Treks. So just a plethora of places for you to be able to find me here on the network, and would love for you to be able to check out all of those other shows. And of course, on the Nerd Party Network, I've got two shows as well. One is a completed show I did with Drea Kaufman, where we talked about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time, which was so much fun, especially if you're a big fan of that series, as I am. And of course, you can find me doing aggressive negotiations with John Mills as we talk about Star Wars each and every week. But Chris, if people do, you know, want to catch up with you and see what your favorite barbecue joints are there in Tokyo, if they actually have those there, where can people find you?
That would be Smokehouse in Harajuku, Matthew. They have wonderful barbecue and great sauces. It's one of the few authentic, I would say, barbecue joints here in
town.
And
you would know. you would know, because we're both from the South, and it's... Yeah. Bad barbecue is not something you want.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And as a backup, if you're in Tokyo, go to Azabu Juban, my friends David and LaTanya Whitaker. LaTanya is from Mississippi and David's from Georgia. So I'm sandwiched in between them in Alabama, but they own a restaurant, Soul Food House. Wonderful soul food.
That sounds amazing.
Wonderful. They do Cajun, Creole, all the good stuff from the South. So visit there.
Oh my gosh.
But when I'm not doing that, Matthew, when I'm not there eating, and I have recovered from overeating, you can find me on the network, as you mentioned, doing shows with you, talking Picard on the Artificial Tango. We have wrapped that up now with the end of season two, but we'll be back for season three. And our Enterprise 20th Anniversary Rewatch on Warp 5, DS9 on the Orb. Larry Nemechek and I do the Ready Room from time to time. There's Interphase and all kinds of other stuff. So check out all of that if you want to hear me talk more about Star Trek. And if you'd like to chat with me about Star Trek in social media or whatever you want to talk about, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. That's my username everywhere in social media, but Twitter is where I am the most active. Now, if you would like to help us keep Saddle Up and all the other shows that we mentioned going, keep the network going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to get involved, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. You can find out how to support the network there. And we really appreciate everyone who is helping us. We would not be here without you. So thank you so very, very much. All right, Matthew. Well, I am going to be having a beer with Pike while I wait for the next episode to air so we can once again talk about it here.
Well, Chris, that sounds fantastic. So let's saddle up, lock and load.